Good evening and welcome to Kadampa Center. These are the brave few who were willing to go out in snow and ice. So glad to see everyone made it here safely. We expect Venerable Rabina any time. But I just wanted to let you know that she announced last week that she was providing course notes. And we have offered to you free copies of the book, and they're on the table in the back. So if you haven't yet seen those, please help yourselves to them anytime. I've also sent out an email on the official email list that gives you links if you'd prefer to have the digital copy for your e-reader or home use. And also the daily practice booklet that she mentioned is being made available just during her visit for free. Normally you'd have to pay for that through FPMT, but we're making that available as well. So if you have any questions about that, please feel free to ask me anytime. Mm-hmm. The Daily Practice Book is a new booklet by Lama Zopa Rinpoche that is his advice and on a daily morning practice.
So we think, as usual, think, put ourselves on the right track, state our purpose. What am I doing here? Why am I sitting here today? Because I want to think about Buddha's take on how things exist, which is actually the basis of his one whole approach to all of Buddha's teachings and practice. And why I want to do this is to get some tools to use in my daily life to help me be in sync with how things exist. And why do I want to do that? Because that's the cause of happiness. Because seeing not being in sync with how things exist is the cause of suffering. I'm sick of suffering. Thank you very much. And then when I do this even more and I see others are in the same boat and I want to be of use to them for my sake and the sake of others, all the way to perfecting my own potential in order to benefit sentient beings. If I don't do it, who will? It's the attitude of the Bodhisattva. So thinking like this, as we sing our little prayer, it sort of expresses that. The first part reminding us of our reliance on the Buddha and his teachings and so on. Sangye charang soke chognam la jangcho baru dagni kyab suchi dagi chanyen gi pe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drobha shok Sangye charang soke chognam la jangcho baru dagni kyab suchi dagi chanyen gi pe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drobha shok Sangye charang soke chognam la jangcho baru Dagni kyab suchi Dagi chanyen gi pe sonam ki Drola penche sangye drobha shok. Yep, so we can see, you know, if we look at the Four Noble Truths, Buddha's packaging of his findings, you know, his first teaching that he gave after he got enlightened in Varanasi, in Saranath, at Deer Park, about suffering. You know, the reference point for the four is suffering. What is it? What are the causes? You can be free of it, and how to do it. So in the second one, which is the causes, this is where he lays out really precisely the causes of suffering. So, you know, if we think, do I want to know how things exist? We think, well, I don't plan to be any kind of scientist. Thank you very much. No. Do you want to be happy? Hey, yes, we'll say. That's definite. That's for sure. That we know we want. Not sure about how things exist. But when we realize Buddha's really simple point expressed in the Second Noble Truth, that the method for getting happy is to see things as they exist. Because why we suffer is because we don't see them as they exist, because we're living in la-la land, living in a bunch of nonsense, seeing things in ways they don't exist. And this is a fascinating approach of Buddha, you know, his take on things. So in the Second Noble Truth, he states the main causes of suffering. Main causes. The main causes. Actually, if you think of any phenomenon that we think about, like a cup or a microphone or a sock or a carpet or a chair or a person, we know that if you had, if you go and buy a carpet or, well, you wouldn't buy a person, but if you did, you'd have a little kind of how-to book. And I mean, they're practically encyclopedias now, instruction of how to put things together, if you had to write a book about how to make a cup, you'd have hundreds and hundreds of causes and conditions, hundreds of things you'd have to get to put together to produce a cup. This is pretty reasonable. We know that the world as we know it, and this is the world of impermanent phenomena, the Buddha's view, the world of impermanent phenomena, of things, in the Buddhist view of, there are various synonyms for impermanent. And so one of them is the word, a product, a thing that's produced. Another one is compounded phenomenon, a thing that is made up of many bits. Well, a cake is a compounded phenomenon, and you get a recipe. It says, get this, 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 and this, and you do this, and you'll get a cake. So we know if we look at anything we can think of in the universe, it's just like that. A cup, a lid, a clock, a sock, they're made up of many bits and pieces. So in other words, the causes of a sock. You don't think of it this way. What are the causes of a sock? What are the causes and conditions that have to come together to produce a sock? Well, you need all those things. And you know perfectly well, and this is a really important point, we know you need, if you're going to get a decent sock, you'd better be accurate. If you want a decent cake, you'd better be accurate. And look at the precision and the immense of time and checking that cooks do before they dare put their name on a cookbook. You understand? They're really confident that every single component is right. They've done that cake repeated times, and now they're confident to write this book. Well, causes and conditions for a cake. We call it a recipe, So, okay, then Buddha's expertise is this, it's called cause and effect, same thing. His expertise is cause and effect. He agrees with the materialist world, the world we all know and take for granted and think is a normal world, that you need to put a bunch of things together. You need to be accurate in getting all the various components to produce a sock, to produce a lid, to produce a clock. Well, his expertise, though, is about happiness and suffering. That's all. That's what he talks about. He says he's got it down, as far as he's concerned, he's got it down, the recipe for happiness and the recipe for suffering. He says we know now perfectly the recipe for suffering, actually. We've got down to perfection and have got it down and had it down for countless eons. He says, although we don't realize it, but what he has found is the recipe for happiness. He's found from his own observation, his own hard work, he's identified exactly what suffering is and the recipe, obviously not to get it, but the recipe that does get it and which therefore to avoid. Because once you've got the causes of suffering down and you know exactly what causes it, in a sense it tells you what are the causes of, how to stop the suffering. First you have to identify exactly the product you're trying to produce or identify a moment of suffering. Then you have to get exactly down the causes of it. And once you've got this, it's easy to find the solution to stop the suffering or to bring happiness. Just flip it over, and what you've got is the causes of happiness. Because happiness is freedom from suffering. It's very simple, it's not complicated. So that's his expertise, that's his thing. That's what Buddha has found to be so. What suffering is and what causes it, and therefore what happiness is and what causes that. What's the recipe for happiness? Well, in the Second Noble Truth, he lays out, indeed, he would agree that many, many, many things have to come together just to produce a moment of suffering. A moment of suffering. He's precise in defining what is suffering. So many things have to come together to produce a moment of suffering. But he narrows it down to two in the Second Noble Truth. He narrows it down to two. Because those two are the ones that if we get on top of those two and stop those two, that we can find the solution. We can find the solution. So the two causes of suffering for the Buddha, one is called karma and the other one's called delusion. Karma, delusion. Karma, delusion. Just two things. So karma, actually it subsumes, they subsume down to the one, delusions. Because karma Okay, delusion is a name that's used in Buddhist psychology, one of the many terms that's used in Buddhist psychology to refer to neurotic states of mind. Let's call them that. The ego-based states of mind, the misconceptions, the delusions, the neuroses, the non-virtues. Broadly speaking, we can say that. There are states of mind in our mental consciousness that are those, that are the voices of ego. And these, the karma and delusions, the two of them come down to one, the main one, the fundamental one, the main one, the essential one, delusions. Delusion is a name for a neurotic state of mind. They are the cause of all suffering, period. Karma comes out of that one. You know, we've talked a bit about karma, and we can see that it's we use that word very colloquially, you know. But actually, the main word, the actual most tasty translation of the word karma is the word intention, thought to do something. That's the beginning of the process of quotes. Creating karma. And of course that's done by the mind. So the mind is everything for the Buddha. Literally, everything comes down to the mind. What goes on in the mind. So, the negative states of mind, the delusions are the main cause of suffering. Because being a state of mind, it's an incorrect state of mind. It isn't seeing things clearly. It's a liar. That's the meaning of the word delusion. You say, you know, you're deluded, you're delusional, a person's saying to you, you're not in sync with reality. That's exactly what Buddha's saying. So delusion is a state of mind, a concept, actually, surprisingly, because they're so intuitive and so instinctive for us, they just feel like great big fat emotions, but they all come down to being a conceptual state of mind, and they literally are misconceptions. So we know very well a misconception is easy. If I say there's two cups on my table, you look at the table, you say, no, Rabin, that's a misconception. There's one. Easy. A misconception. A thought in my mind that says there are two cups on my table. That's a simple example. And even this simple example of having a misconception, you can see the drama that will come, that will cause for me. You know, I'm convinced there are two cups on my table. You can start to think of imagine all the problems that will come from this. That will end up with a war, you know. Just not being in touch with reality. It's very surprising to us because we would never think that, you know, the ordinary ways we suffer, it has like nothing to do with what we think, having, you know, some misconception in my own mind, that seeing things in a wrong way, that's why I'm suffering. I mean, that's like a cosmic joke to us. I mean, as Lama Zopa says, most ordinary people, the world, have no idea that their mind, that what goes on in their mind, plays any role at all in their lives. This is the level to which we are so deluded, Buddha says. The level to which we are so living in misconceptions, living in fantasy worlds, you know. So all, you know, in Buddhist psychology, very simple, in the mental consciousness, in our, we have sensory and mental. And sensory are just these dumb animals, you know, that just perceive shape and color and a few other things. We give them a lot more power than they really do. But all they do is perceive certain characteristics of a phenomenon, like the shape and color here, you know. Ears just merely hear sound. Taste merely perceives taste. We think they see more and do more and taste more and hear more. They don't. But mostly it's the mental consciousness. That's where the workshop is, as Lama Zopa puts it. That's where all the stories and the dramas and the misconceptions and that's where all the happiness and the suffering is. That's where the causes of happiness and the causes of suffering are. That's why we have to know our minds. It's not just some side thing you better meditate. It's absolutely fundamental to being a Buddhist. It's what Buddhism's about, you know. And eventually, I mean, we have to begin that junior school, you start, you know, you control your body and speech, you be a nice person, don't kill, don't lie, don't steal. That's first step. So you harness your crazy verbal and physical energy. Then you've got the space and time to look inside and start sorting your mind out, which is the point, you know. So in this mental consciousness of ours, we've got these three, as we've discussed, three categories of states of mind. Positive, negative, neutral. I mean, it gets more, it's more detailed in the certain kind of different ways of seeing, but a simple way of putting it, there are states of mind that are peaceful, virtuous, appropriate, useful, and to some extent, until you realize emptiness, and we'll explain this, in sync with reality. and they're the cause of happiness. Then the others, the neuroses, the misconceptions, the delusions, the fears, the dramas, and that we all know those, attachment, anger, pride, jealousy, all the other drama, rooting it right down into the root, the mother of them all, called simply ignorance, but known very tastily as ego grasping. These are the cause of suffering. They are the ones that are called misconceptions. They're the delusions. They're the liars. And they're the ones we have to identify. So in general, they all function in the same way. One, they have the characteristic such that when you're caught up in any one of these, to whatever extent, to that extent, you are miserable. Just by definition, they are, in their nature, disturbing. One of the terms for them is disturbing emotion. But the other one is the point that gets you tonight. The other one is this delusional characteristic. This delusional characteristic. This characteristic they all possess of being a thought, coming down to being a thought, surprisingly to us, because we just think of it as feelings, anger. It seems like a joke to call anger a feeling, a thought. That comes down to being a thought. But so habituated, so strong in our minds, we're so habituated with it that it's now at the level of our body and is a very intense physical feeling, you know. So they all function the same way. They're disturbing and they're delusional. But the root delusion is the one we want to get to tonight. But they all once we can understand the other ones, we can understand this one better. It's easy to understand. This delusional aspect. So it's very evident. We analyze attachment. One of its functions, it's multifaceted, but it's the main one, that's the main voice of ego grasping, you could say it is this one of attachment, that effectively runs our lives. But beneath it is this ego grasping, this ignorance, maripa, ignorance. So this attachment is easy enough to see how it's a misconception. Like we discuss all the time, when you look at that cup, you might go, oh, I don't like that cup much. And, you know, it's a bit ugly. And I might go, wow, what a pretty cup. So each of us is obviously, you know, so then my attachment is over-exaggerating its prettiness. And then I start possessing it and buy it and call it mine and everything. You know, it gets closer and closer and more like this, you know, my cup. It is very funny. It reminded me, His Holiness said, it's so funny how ridiculous minds work. You're at the market and you're checking up all the oranges. You know, you're feeling the oranges. And they're just a bunch of oranges there ready to buy. And then you decide that's your orange and you buy it, you pick it up, and then it drops on the ground. You get really upset because my orange dropped on the ground. My orange. Straight away. As soon as you decide to buy that orange. It's so true. I thought it was so funny. Who cares if the others fell off the ground? You know, I didn't buy them, but my orange. I remember that. Anyway. So attachment over-exaggerates, and it causes all this multiple other things, you know, possessiveness and expectation, all these dramas. But the fundamental core job of the delusions is to exaggerate, to embellish, to exaggerate. And you have, ooh, what an ugly cup. Your aversion is a state of mind in your mind, and that exaggerates the ugliness of the cup. So we can certainly see this when it comes to people. Your friends and your enemies. Enemy is aversion in my mind that makes him look as ugly as can be. I go away from him. And you're, you know, but he's your beloved. When you see him, you faint with pleasure and you rush towards him like a magnet. We know this. We all take this for granted, but this is so powerful. Simply that statement, you know. So we can see how attachment and aversion, and we run between these 1,000 times a day, how they over-exaggerate the characteristics of the event, the person, the thing, the cup, the whatever it might be. This is what samsara means. This is being in samsara, is caught up in these stories, you know. These words sound so simple, but they're so profoundly deep inside us, therefore so hard to unpack and to get rid of. So, the one that underpins even them, that's this one called ignorance, or colloquially known as ego grasping, which is a very tasty way it functions within us every second, you know. And this too, we don't even have a name for it in our culture. It's really hard to see this because it's in every other thing that we experience. It informs all of our other neurotic emotions, and it even informs our goodness at the moment. You know, is this misconception that it functions in the same way as the other ones, that it embellishes something. It exaggerates the characteristics of something. And this is where it gets tricky for us, you know. So your aversion causes this cup to appear ugly to you. But the ignorance in your mind underneath the aversion that informs the aversion that is absolutely completely implicit in it causes the cup to appear ugly from its own side, ugly out there from its own side, ugly out there from its own side in and of itself. These are the words. Now, as soon as we can say it appears ugly, we get that. But it appears to exist from its own side, we go, what? That's when we get puzzled, isn't it? Because it's such a more primordial delusion. It's in the mind. It informs all the others. Meaning, if that weren't in the mind, we would not have attachment and aversion. If it were not in the mind, we would not suffer, period. We would be out of samsara. So it's so primordial. Like I said, we don't really have a name for it in any of our psychological models. It's so primordial, so instinctive, and it informs, it underpins every second of our experiences. You could say that. So even the virtues are underpinned by it. So, you know, you'll say, Mary, what a kind person Mary is. You know, you have affection for Mary. You feel compassion for Fred. You see him suffering. That's a virtue. It's not disturbing. And it's not delusional, to some extent. It's relatively reasonable. It's relatively in touch with reality, and I'll explain. But it's still, as long as you haven't realized emptiness, as long as you've still got this ignorance in the mind, it is also underpinned by the assumption of ignorance. Meaning, this, even the, so there's you know, a self-existent I having compassion for a self-existent you. There's still a separateness. There's still a dualism. There's still a separate me and you. So as long as there's ignorance in the mind, this marigpa in Tibetan, this ego grasping, even there can be love and compassion, but you won't ever get out of samsara. You'll never stop the suffering because the root of suffering is this ego grasping. And that needs to be uprooted to stop suffering, to stop samsara, to stop suffering, to achieve liberation from suffering. You can be kind and loving till the cows come home. You can even have bodhicitta. But until you haven't realized emptiness, until you have cut the root, this root delusion, you won't ever get out of samsara. So there's many, many ways to approach this teaching of the Buddha. But the one that as Lama's Yeshe paraphrases, Lama Tsongkhapa, our lineage Lama, the Lhokpa lineage Lama, he, you know, Lama Tsongkhapa loves, especially runs with the approach of this approach here called the two truths, the view of conventional truth and ultimate truth. It's Buddha's teaching, but Tsongkhapa really runs with this one. And as Lama Yeshe says, paraphrasing Tsongkhapa, this conventional truth, the one that's known as, you know, as His Holiness says, it's the Buddhist slogan known as dependent arising. Or you hear interdependence or dependent origination. Different terms you hear. This is the king of logics, as Lama Yeshe puts it, to prove emptiness. So, the two truths are there's conventional reality and there's ultimate reality. Just words for it. Conventional truth, ultimate truth. Things exist conventionally and then things have an ultimate way of existing. Or strictly speaking, not existing. It's about existence. It's about how things exist. This is really where we get into the nitty-gritty, the nuts and bolts, the bare bones, the essence of Buddha's teachings on how things exist precisely. We look at the world, you know, if you look at this Heart Sutra, here the Heart Sutra, you begin, all of the Heart Sutra is just this list of different groupings of things that exist in the world that Buddha's saying we need to repeatedly and at great depth look into in order to understand the emptiness of each individual one of them. And so the first the first sentence of it, starting with the grouping called the five aggregates. It's a particular grouping of five components that Buddha, for very good reasons, selects five bits of us and says we're made up of these five. So the five aggregates. And the first one is the one called form, which is a term that refers to the physical part of us, the physical part. So the first sentence in the thing, or one of the first sentences says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, form is nothing other than emptiness, and emptiness is nothing other than form. So this is where the two truths come together. If we hear on the normal world about ultimate reality and conventional reality, right now, Buddha says, when we hear these two, we at the moment don't have in our mind at all an understanding of the two truths. We've got two extreme views deep in the bones of our being. And even when we do hear the two truths, we don't hear them properly. We hear them wrongly. Because we're stuck at the moment in two extreme non-truths, it's a way of putting it. So we either have the view, most of us don't think this way at all unless we study a philosophy, but we could extrapolate and look at the way the materialist view is, if we put words upon it. This would be this one view, this extreme view, the wrong view, the Buddha would call it, of nihilism. So what's a better word we'd call for that is depressed. If you put words to depression when it's very deep, it's I'm worthless, life is nothing, there is no purpose, there is no point. Isn't that depression? Well, that's actually the nihilistic philosophical view. And when we, and the trouble is now, when we hear the right, if we start studying the Buddhist philosophy, when we hear the right view, according to Buddha, of emptiness, we hear nihilism. We hear it that way. And then when we hear the conventional truth, dependent arising, we hear the wrong view, Buddha calls it, of eternalism, of grasping at something as permanent and uncaused, and usually that's so, and actually in this, you know, when we've got that view firmly in our mind, one consequence of this is that's why everything is perfect in life. Finally I found happiness. So finally I found happiness. You're in bliss, you've met your soulmate, now I've found happiness. You're in bliss and you've met a soulmate, and then you extrapolate and you go, now I have finally found happiness. Don't we say that? That's the eternalistic view. In other words, instinctively, it's like, now it's all perfect. Now I've got it. Now I'm happy. We will be together until we're 80. Definite, absolute truth. That's the eternalistic view. And it's a spontaneous and natural emotional experience we have when everything's all hunky-dory and gorgeous and perfect. And when everything crashes to the ground, it leaves you for your younger version, you crash down to the depressed one or the nihilistic one. I might as well kill myself. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. These, emotionally speaking, we recognize completely. We would never have given words to them. Oh, I have a philosophical view of nihilism. Who would have thought, you know? Oh, I must have the philosophical view of eternalism here. Who would have said that? We don't. So you could say the philosophical positions called the creator religions are an expression of the eternalistic philosophical view. Permanent, uncaused, source of all happiness, God, you know, and soul. So it's a way of, it's a way when what Buddha does is go into this in much more subtle detail and look into the nuts and bolts of what, unpacking where this comes from in our own mind, unpacking the logic or the lack of logic behind these views, you know, that go on in the mind. Unpack, sort of like, you know, you've got a sickness, you've got an illness. That a person who's skillful can look into it and understand all the bits and pieces. Well, the joint this and the that and you go there and here. But you just know it's a big fat pain. That's what we have to do. We have to all become skillful scientists in understanding our own ordinary daily views and feelings and emotions. That's exactly what we have to do. So our normal way of thinking is, well, that's the philosopher's job. That's the scientist's job. But the Buddha says, in order to stop suffering, we all have to do it. It's our job. We have to do it. You can't shortcut it. If you want to stop suffering, you've got to understand emptiness. If you want to stop suffering, you've got to understand how things exist. You can't bypass it. It's not a question of believing it. It's bizarre to think that believing in surgery, believing in medicine will help you become a good doctor. I'm sorry, You've got to go learn it. Same here. Everyone has to do it if you want to stop suffering. So we've got to unpack all our instinctive, seemingly instinctive natural emotions and go beyond and put a microscope of our mind on them and observe exactly how they work and see the faults and fix the faults in order to get in sync with the right view with how things actually exist. So remember, Buddha's not asking you to believe this. He's allowed to say this is correct. We get a bit nervous if we hear this because we think, you know, that sounds like fundamentalism. He's forcing us to believe him. No. You know, if I'm Einstein telling you about my findings about relativity, you'd need me to be confident. If I'm going to sit up here and say, well, I'm not sure if I'm right and it's all the same anyway and everyone can think what they like, well, you know, I'm wasting your money and time. But he's not asking you. He's confident he's right, but he's not asking us to believe him. And the same with Buddha. He's confident to present what he has found to be so. His findings from his own hard work about how things exist. And all the masters and all the holy beings since then in this lineage of this unbroken lineage of practices and traditions and learning and meditation since then. So it's up to us to engage in it, you know. Learn the words, learn the theories, learn the concepts, and then slowly through practice begin to identify this exact process in our own mind. But you've got to start intellectual first. You've got to start with the intellectual first. Can't shortcut. So, okay. Then it's putting these, you know, Buddha talks about middle way. We've got the extreme views and we have the middle way. We really have a misconception of middle way. Most people think middle way means being sort of balanced. A balanced lifestyle. Bit of sleep, bit of wake, bit of anger, bit of love, bit of food, bit of this. It's just a really pathetic misconception. Middle way is referring to a particular way of seeing the universe. And the real middle way, finally, is when you finally become an enlightened being, then you really actually have no longer the contradiction between these two truths, no longer a contradiction between appearances and reality, how things exist, conventional and ultimate. Even till the highest yogis still see appearances in one way, the conventional truth, and then in their meditation they see emptiness. So it's only finally the Buddha's mind can see conventional and ultimate simultaneously, the non-duality of this. So middle way is not that kind of meaning at all, remotely. So middle way between these two extremes. So right now they're like way apart in our minds, you know. Therefore we go up and down like yo-yos, grasping frantically of these things here, which is where attachment manifests, and then becoming profoundly depressed and have aversion down here where we want to go kill ourselves. These are the emotional expressions, I tell you, of these two misconceptions. So, what are the words for these misconceptions? So let's put them in the context of the two truths, Buddha's way of describing conventional, how things exist conventionally, and what is the ultimate existence of things, or non-existence, really. So the first thing to do is if we're going to discuss how things exist, we need to establish what a thing is that we're prepared to discuss. That's pretty obvious. And the Buddha's saying in the Heart Sutra, basically he just lists these lists of the groups of phenomena in the universe. And there's no type of phenomena left out, according to the Buddhist way of looking at things. Just the groupings of phenomena, the 12 links, the 4, the 16, the 18 sense something or others, whatever they call the six senses, the 8 six senses, the 6 objects of the sense of the 6 sense bases, the 18 constituents or something, the 12 links, the four noble truths, these different things, all the things that exist. The 5 aggregates, or to look repeatedly and continuously at how they exist. And that finally there's no contradiction between emptiness and conventional truth. And they're the two extremes we have now, you know. So, okay. If we're going to discuss how things exist, let's even establish how you establish that something exists. How do you do this? Already this is so tasty. Well, you know, one I always give is, you know, Mum, what's a cup? I'm a kid, I don't know what a cup is. Well, I mean, what's a cup, Mum? And she'll point to that and she'll go, it's that flat bottom clay container over there, you know, with a handle. And I kind of get those words and I'll say, yeah, I see it. Yeah, right. Oh, good, thank you. Well, that's only the first part of the definition. You need to have a definition. Very clear. We've got to be on the same page. So then I'll say, but what does it do? What's its function? Well, darling, it holds my tea. That's a definition of a cup, a flat bottom clay container that holds tea or holds liquids, holds your drink, holds your beverage. Americans don't even think it's funny, but nobody in the world says beverage except you guys. You realize that? But you never use it at home. You don't say, well, I'm an American, I can say we, can't I? We don't say, oh, may I have a beverage, Mum, do we? We don't say that, do we? So why do we say it another way? It's very strange. Beverage. Only Americans. Only we Americans. Okay. It holds my beverage. So you go, who says? Who says it's a cup? This is how we think. Well, pretty reasonable. Well, let's prove it, Buddha says. It's a conventional truth. It didn't come from on high. No, a creator didn't give it to us. It's not self-existent. This is the point. We prove it's a cup. I get my tea and I pour it in. Okay, look, I just proved it held it held a beverage. So that's, we said, what its function was, isn't it? So what's a knife? A long piece of metal with a sharp edge. What does it do? It cuts things. Well, let's prove it. Get a thing and cut it. There it is. You proved it is a knife. It's valid to be called a knife. Now, this is interesting because we know this when it comes to cakes and science. We're geniuses at doing things like this. We're very precise and accurate. But this is the trouble when it comes to happiness and emotions and feelings. We haven't got a clue on earth. We I say I love you and you say you love me. And we actually think we've got the same definition. Complete joke. Because we don't bother defining our terms on a cup. That's why we have fights and wars. I meant this. No, you meant that. Because we never defined our terms. If we all talked about cakes and like that, we'd never have a cake. We'd never get a cake. We'd never have a building. We'd never have a computer. We'd never have anything. So we understand precision. But when it comes to physical things only, when it comes to the body, when it comes to emotions and feelings, we're lost completely. And every single psychological model on our earth has different definitions of everything. Every day there's another person coming up with another model. There's no certainty. There's no agreement. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? So it really shows we are sort of stumbling. Okay. So that's a cup, a flat bottom container that holds tea. So we're not quite convinced yet it's a cup. We haven't really proved it totally. Apparently you have to now get to make sure there are no other valid cognitions of it that contradicts that. So there's a very clear way of saying what a valid cognition is, you know. It's a state of mind that's not incorrect, that sees something accurately. So there's ways of, you know, we've got to prove these things. So we have all this ready, and now we can begin to discuss the way a cup exists. And the thing is, the universe, as we can see, I mean, the Heart Sutra is taking every grouping of everything in the universe. And they all exist the same way, Buddha says. They all exist the same way. The two truths apply to everything. So there's another phenomenon, isn't there, that does exist. And that's called a person, or a self, or an I. These all words are synonymous. I, person, self. They're all synonymous. So there is a cup that does exist, that does function to hold a cup, to hold a beverage. So the same reasoning can be used to prove that there is a person called Robina sitting in this chair here in this center at this time tonight. See, because we hear no self and selflessness, we get very confused. This word, Atma, Buddha came out of the Hindu tradition, and that's their big trip. It was all about how the self exists. And as His Holiness pointed out, it was the Hindus, maybe 3,000 years ago, who began this remarkable, amazing conversation about the nature of a self. What is a self? What constitutes a self? That's the tastiest central discussion that Buddha is on about. But it applies to the same discussion. It applies to a cup as well. Because if we have a misconception about the self, which he says we do have, which is the cause of all suffering, we also have a misconception about a cup in the same way. And so Atma, so the Buddha basically, you know, went through that system and it continued. And this is where Buddhism developed. Because he came up with his very arguments from his own direct experience in meditation and disagrees with the findings about an Atma, a self. And then over the centuries, there are various Buddhist interpretations of this. You know, so when you study Buddhist tenets, guess it goes to teaching, isn't it? Tenets, isn't it? He's going to teach soon, right? Good. Which is the traditional Indian text on the different schools of thought about the way things exist, particularly the one about the self. There's different interpretations, which we can discuss hopefully tonight. So, the crucial thing is, we are talking about how things, listen to the words, we're describing, Buddha talks about how things, conventionals, how conventional truth called a cup or a person, how finally it actually exists. Final, ultimate, they mean the same, you know. So you've got to, in order to understand the emptiness of a self, the emptiness of a cup, the emptiness of a clock, you have to first establish a self, establish a cup, establish a clock. A conventional thing that does exist, that does function in the way you define it. Once you've got it down what it is, then you can proceed to discuss how it exists. So there has to be a self that you point to as a conventional self in order to discuss the emptiness of that. So that this immediately, instantly annihilates the misconception of nihilism. There is no self, which is where we run to the moment we hear emptiness. Instinctively. Because in reality, these two truths, that things exist conventionally, implies the ultimate way that they exist, which is emptiness. And every time you say emptiness, it implies this one. So in other words, dependent arising, which is the label given to how things exist conventionally. That's one of the ways of presenting. It's the term used to refer to how things exist conventionally. That things exist, a cup exists, in dependence upon various factors. And there's in the Buddhist discussions of the nature of things, of three, you can talk about two or three levels of understanding how a cup exists conventionally. And so, what happens is this. Well, we've got the wrong views right now. Whenever if we start to study the philosophy, which we're doing, you know, in this place, so we think, well, as soon as we hear the words, there is no cup from its own side, there is no cup in and of itself, there is no cup out there inherently, there's no cup from its own side, there's no cup out there from its own side, in and of itself, these are the different synonyms. As soon as we hear those words, as soon as we hear there's no cup out there from its own side, we go, we chuck the baby out with the bathwater and we become nihilistic instinctively, naturally. And we go, oh, well, there's no cup. As Buddhists, we make this mistake. As soon as we say, oh, well, it's all empty anyway, it doesn't matter. That's a nihilistic statement. That's an incorrect statement. It feels like that when we say it. Oh, well, it's all empty anyway, it doesn't matter. That's a common phrase people use. A complete misconception. You just chuck the baby out with the bathwater. It's meaningless. It's a mistake. And we run there immediately. Then as soon as we hear, it's okay. As soon as we hear, dependent arising, that there is a cup that does exist, that does function, that holds my tea. We are so relieved. And then we grasp, oh, thank God, there is something after all. Phew. Will go. We just embellish. We just over-exaggerate. Here we under-exaggerate the cup. Here we over-exaggerate. And so we think, there must be a cup after all. Well, come on, Buddha, make up your mind. First you tell me there's no cup, and now you tell me there is a cup. Which is it? Well, we've got to understand that it's both. And that's the point. To get to see how these two truths are really like flip sides of the same coin. This is what we have to do. That's why we have to be so precise in our use of words, in the discussions, in the, you know, in the understanding of it, in the thinking about it, so we can meditate on it. And slowly, slowly, the penny begins to drop, you know. So, let's unpack some of these thoughts. So what is the way in which a cup does exist as a dependent arising? That's the thing, a dependent arising. It arises, it exists in dependence upon various factors. So there's three different levels, like I said, which are really just discussions with the position, the misconceptions. They're arguments with the misconceptions about how things exist. And the same discussion applies to I, a person, or a cup. No difference. So the first one. The first one is that a cup exists in dependence upon causes and conditions. This is arguing all Buddhist schools agree with this one, and this is arguing with the Hindu position that there is a self that is permanent. Meaning here, permanent has the two meanings. We say permanent in our world, it means lasting forever, but a subtler meaning of permanence here is the opposite to the subtler meaning of impermanence, which is that it changes from moment to moment. It changes from moment to moment. It changes from moment to moment. Not just it comes and it's like it stops. So this idea in the Hindu tradition, and this is a similar view of God and a similar view of a soul, is that it is something that is permanent, that doesn't change from moment to moment. So what Buddha would say is we look into our own being, our instinctive feeling. That's what we feel about things. That's why when everything, now I found happiness, it's because it's happy today. Because I feel happy today and I found my soulmate. Finally, I found happiness. What we just are doing in that statement is imposing permanence upon it, meaning unchangingness, unchangingness. We intellectually know we're going to get fat and old and have grey hair and 7 babies and grandchildren, fight and maybe even, you know, who knows what. But that when you got it, when attachment's running the show, you grasp like a vampire at the permanent, divine, eternalistic, perfect little bubble that we've just got. That is the meaning, how we grasp at it as permanent. And all the bliss from this, you know. And therefore the unbearableness when it changes. We can see. And it's just the same when, you know, he leaves you for the younger version. This is now permanent as well, you know. Isn't it? You can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. Just can't see it's going to ever change. This is the feeling we have. We have this feeling deep in our bones. And it's one of these primordial misconceptions that we have, you know. So the very first philosophical position that Buddha's arguing with, this is the position of the Hindus, this is where he diverged from the Hindus, that they say, when you read the Hindu tradition, the Hindu teachings, it's like emptiness. There's an enormous understanding of letting go and impermanence and it's all illusion, all this talk. But there's a very subtle still, a position they hold on to that there is something that is permanent, that is inherent, that is unchanging. And that's the view that Buddha then, that's where he moved on from and said, no, that is not accurate. That there is no self that does exist, that doesn't depend upon causes, conditions, that doesn't change from moment to moment. That's the first level of selflessness. And for all the positions in all the Buddhist schools, except for the Prasangika school, which is the school of thinking called the consequentialist, which is the higher school of the middle way philosophical position, which is the one that Geshe-la would teach from, that His Holiness teaches, that our lamas teach. For all the other schools of thought, this is the gross selflessness. So we might think we think about things like that. We didn't have those words. We didn't learn that at school. But all Buddha's saying is we have this position deep in our bones, this grasping at a thing is permanent, just instinctively, which is why we suffer. We've got it down to perfection. It's virtually instinctive now. We would not put, it's like, you know you've got a pain, you can't put words to it. We know we do this, but we don't know how to put words to it. And this is what we have to learn to do, so we can unpack it and change it. So there's all sorts of arguments. So when it comes to a person, the object called person, I, self, the discussion about causes and conditions is karma. It's perfect. Karma, the law of karma, is simply saying that I, this object called self or I, that is instinctively believed to be, you know, causeless. Look at how we feel now. The way we feel now, which we could say is our materialist philosophical position. But even with mummy not telling me, I would already have this because it's deep in our bones. Is this feeling? Look at the feeling we have. We say it. I didn't ask to get born. Nothing to do with me. I'm this innocent victim that got plonked on this earth by somebody else. Not my fault. This is the deepest instinct of ego. It's not my fault. We do everything in our power to not be the blame. You know. To avoid blame, to avoid the firing line, everything, we can't stand our negativities being pointed out. We can't stand them, even all our mistakes even being seen. We just want to frantically live in denial, push it away. Not my fault. It's always someone else out there. And that's the classic way the world suffers. This is the position of this ego grasping, this gross level of believing there's this innocent victim, me, who didn't ask to get born, who got made by somebody else, and therefore it's all their fault out there somewhere. And then day-to-day life, it's always someone else's fault. Like Lama Zopa says, we don't even know our mind plays a role. Not to mention that what I did in the past lives created me. This is an outrageous concept. So the materialist view is a perfect philosophical position of this one. That we didn't ask to get born. It's the exact, it's the position of the philosophical view. It's the philosophical position of the materialist scientific view. A person is made by another, a mummy and daddy. And also the Christian teaching, not being rude, but just pointing it out, the creator religion is the same. Someone else makes me. So it brings this natural sense of an innocent victim. Nothing to do with me. Meaning what I do and I say, we don't have a feeling that I play any role at all in my life. And even if we grow up, we know we should become accountable and grow up, but we mostly don't. We live with blame and resentment and jealousy and attachment and anger. They are all the expressions of this misconception. The innocent victim. So the view of karma, not only, you know, could you be accountable? But the Buddha would say, you are the total person who made you. You are the one who made you. This is a cosmic joke, the Buddha's saying. You, your own past actions. Every single microsecond of what you thought before, what you did before, what you said before, programmed your consciousness, caused you to run to that lousy mother, have that horrible father, that delicious person, that ugly thing, that money in the bank, that whatever it might be. There's nothing that we experience in this world, the Buddha would say, every sentient being is the same, that isn't the fruit mainly of my past actions. I mean, it's an outrageous concept, and it's the perfect proof of emptiness. I'm made up of countless causes and conditions, and I did them all. I didn't do them all, the conditions are out there too, but I'm the main one. My past actions are the main one. This is a powerful argument against grasping the innocent victim me, you know. The concrete me, the permanent me. I had nothing to do with me, that one. It's not my fault, me. Even the good things happening, it's not my fault, is it? You know, it's the cake's fault. Look, what can I do? Stuff it in, that's all. I can't help it. It's the cake's fault, being so delicious. Really, that's how we feel. The innocent victim feels this way. I remember one time, you know, when I was a bit of a radical feminist, and I'd go around abusing any man who dared to say something about my very nice chest. I had a very nice chest when I was younger. And then it wasn't politically incorrect, was it, of course? You could say what you like in the streets, you know. So I had a policy that I'd go and shout at him and abuse him and make him embarrassed. Whatever. Anyway, in this one time in London, I did this. Abused this fellow for saying something about my chest. And he practically burst into tears. This is the point. He said, if you don't want me to say something, why are you dressed like that? I mean, I just had a shirt on, you know, because I had to have a chest. That's how I was made. Well, understand my point. I wasn't naked or anything. In other words, that's the feeling of attachment. Especially a person, you know, I might be attached to cake. You blame the cake for making you attached. You know, well, when a person's attached to handsome boys or gorgeous girls, that's the classic view. You blame the girl. I mean, even as a Catholic, if a boy got excited looking at me, it was my sin. Do you understand that? Did you know that? So that's that view. That's the view of of innocent victim. It's someone else's fault. They do it to you. So we can see we're interdependent. We can see that people seduce and do this and make us do things because we are interdependent. But the feeling of ego is this: I'm an innocent victim. It's not my fault. I can't help it. You know, that's the view of ego, and that's how we feel every day. The self-pity me, as Amiya, she calls it. So by thinking about karma, completely changes this, rips out the ego grasping, gives enormous courage because it brings accountability. It stops the self-pity me, which is the application of cause and effect, which is the first level in which things exist interdependently. The first argument to counteract grasping at a permanent out there thing, you know, or here thing. The second one, more subtle, more is tasty one. So instead of cup, we can use the object again here called I. Self, me, I. You know, each of us in this room is a phenomenon called an I, a self, a person. That's all. The cup, we're not cups, we're not clocks, we're persons. Okay, so this argument goes, and this is the subtle selflessness for most of the Buddhist schools, but this is the gross selflessness for the Prasakika Majjhimika. Is that we feel instinctively in our bones, and this is a misconception, that there is an I in there somewhere over and above the parts, more than the parts. That somehow it's like the feeling we have mostly, it's like the owner of the parts. This is very deep inside us. Very. When we hear there isn't, it's beyond puzzling. We really believe, utterly in our bones, every second, that there is, in other words, there's a component. If we think a person is made up of a bunch of components, it's true, isn't it? Everything that's an impermanent phenomenon, everything that's impermanent, like a cup or a person, is made up of bits and pieces. We know that, isn't it? If you want to build a cup, you need lots of bits and pieces and put them all together. Then you get the cup. If you want a building, you've got to put all the bits and pieces together and then you get a building. We know this, it's hardly rocket science. Well, a person is exactly the same, made up of bits and pieces. And so Buddha's breaks us down into these five. He's got a particular reason for choosing these five. But never mind whether it's five or 95, that's not the issue here. The fact is, anything that is impermanent, we know, is made up of a bunch of components. We know that. So think of a person like that. You know, you're made up of a bunch of components. Well, to keep it really simple, we could narrow it down to two for the Buddha. Body and mind. So we know that body, you know, has got hundreds of components, hasn't it? And a mind has hundreds of components, all the different states of mind, the sensory, the eye consciousness, the ear consciousness, all the delusions and all the virtues and all the other states of mind, hundreds, thousands of components. Think of it really practically. So not components like a brain, because remember, mind isn't physical. But so the components, the parts, the bits that make up a mind are moments of mind. It's the simplest way to put it. A moments of mind. This moment of my mind and the next moment of my mind and the previous moment of my mind, as well as all the anger and the love. There's millions of bits and pieces that make up the phenomenon called my mind. And there's millions of bits and pieces, you agree, that make up the components called my body. And then there's all those two coming together, millions of those components that make up the phenomenon called me. You with me, people? We're communicating, right? Pretty straightforward. Hardly rocket science. So here's the point. We know we're made up of components. But we believe absolute truth that among the components, knees and joints and pee-pee and caca and blood and bones and eyelashes and anger and love and kindness, all the bits of me, right? We know, we believe absolutely, without question, that there is another component, the main component, another component called I. We believe that absolutely implicitly. It seems bizarre to even say this sentence, that there isn't a particular component called I. We believe it totally. Listen to our mind. the main thought in our head, the reference point for all thoughts, is the thought, I, as if there were that component. So there's lots of little arguments we need to learn to use to break down, logical arguments, to break down this primordial misconception. Are we communicating so far? Because you see, the Christians will say there is one. It's called a soul. The Hindus say there is one. It's called an atma. And then each of them argues slightly differently exactly what that is. Something more subtle, more subtle. But there's got to be something they say there. And the Prasangika Majjhimika view, which they say is the actual meaning of Buddha, Buddha's actual intent, is there is nothing in the person. There's nothing among the parts. There's not a single thing from the side of the person among the parts. There's a thing called I. Okay, let's just discuss, try and see how that's true. One way they say is, we have right now, is the simple way of saying, there is, conventionally speaking, there is an eye, there is a cup that does function to hold my tea. Look, I just proved it. Look, here I am, drinking from it. But what we don't realize is, we don't realize, like with the eye, that delusion, ignorance is imposing a self-existent cup in there among the parts somewhere. We don't think of it, we think of it this way. That's why we have to unpack it. Buddha is saying, sort of like there's a right cup and there's a wrong cup. There's a right eye and a wrong eye. There's a right eye and a wrong eye. There is an eye that does function. This eye here, the name for this eye on this chair is, we know, called Ravina. The name for the eye over there is called Sarah. The name for that cup, that thing there is a cup. The name for that thing there is a, whatever it is, a gong. So, okay, so let's get the right eye and the wrong eye. I have to keep doing the same exercise. I do the same one every time, and I'll do it again. Okay. My table has a cup, a plate, and a clock. So have a look. You all agree, yeah? A conventional statement of simple truth. We know the definition of my table, because if the voice from this chair says my table, we all will look to something next to her, because we know the definition of my. We've learned the English word. We know the definition. Then we know the definition of table, and put those two together, my table, we know the definition, a flat thing that holds things with legs, you know, whatever. We know the definition of cup, we know the definition of plate, you know, and we know the definition of clock. So we've got that down. We all agree on this convention. So there's no one in the room arguing that ain't a plate, Ravina. We have to have a discussion. We've established plate, cup, my table and clock. So we all agree upon that, that they are those things. So then we agree also the number. We agree there are four phenomena just been mentioned. My table is the name of one phenomenon. Cup, plate and clock. Except four separate phenomena. So to really prove that conventionally that's a true statement, conventionally, just ordinary world, you'd have to separate, you'd have to find four separate phenomena, wouldn't you? Do you agree? You'd have to locate and isolate and identify a table that isn't the cup, a plate and a clock. A clock that isn't the table, a plate and a cup, etc. You agree, isn't it? Obvious. So you really prove it's a true statement. Those four things do exist in that, when I say my table has that. Okay, that's easy to do. There's a table, there's the cup, there's the plate, and there's the clock. Look, you can see. Simple, no drama. Not complicated. So I'd say an exactly similar sentence. I will say another sentence identical. I will say, I have a nose, a hand, and a foot. Conventionally speaking, do you accept that?
Yes.
Okay, good. So we have to prove the same thing. Four phenomena, eye, nose, hand, foot. We have to, it's the same. It's the same. Same statement. There has to be four phenomena. And each, obviously, this is, they call this the single and multiple. There's this argument they use, single and multiple. So there has to be an eye. There has to be a foot that isn't a hand, a nose, or an eye. There has to be a hand that isn't a hand, a foot, a nose, and an eye. There has to be a nose that isn't a hand, and a blah, blah, blah. You get my point? Same thing? You agree so far? So good, we can do this. Look, there's the foot, there's the nose, and there's the hand. You accept that's possible, don't you? You accept that is possible, don't you? Okay, so now please isolate the component called I that is not the nose, the hand, the foot, or anything else for that matter. It's very annoying, isn't it? You understand? So give it a go. Try. See if you can come up with something that you think is the I that isn't those things. Any clues? Any ideas? This is what all the schools do. They say there is something. Each of them accept the present giggle like Amika says. There is something that you can refer to say that is the basis of the I, the label. What do you think it could be? Just say, don't try to be clever, you know. Just say what feels in your mind, you know.
Speaker.
Huh? Speaker. What's that mean? Who's the speaker? Okay, so I am the, so who is the, what is the, okay, what is the part of, I said, remember I, Rabina is the name for this phenomenon here, you agree?
Yes.
And Rabina has a nose, a hand, and a foot.
Yes.
You agree with that statement? So we have to find four separate phenomena, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
If there's going to be a conventional truth, you agree?
Mm-hmm.
So we remove the nose, we remove the hand, and we remove the foot. Now remove the Rabina, the piece called Rabina from these parts. That isn't the nose, the hand, the foot, or my knee, or anything else. Which is the part that's called Rabina that isn't the rest?
The one who's made the statement, the speaker.
But I've just put some pieces there. We have to find a Rabina that isn't the nose, the hand, and the foot. If there's four phenomena that exist, we have to find a piece of, we have to find a piece called Rabina that isn't the nose. But isn't the ear, the hand, the foot, the nose, the pee-pee, caca, love, hate, and mind, and everything else? So where is there a piece that isn't all the other parts called Rabina, that is Rabina, that isn't the rest? It has to be something separate from the rest, like we proved here.
Well, if it's your mind, and the mind is not physical, then you're not going to be able to extrapolate.
We can say there's an anger moment of mind, a kind moment of mind. We can't see it physically, it's true, but we can locate angry mind, loving kind, this, that, this moment of mind, yesterday's mind, tomorrow's mind. We can do that.
But you are also the stream of moments.
It's
of
true,
mind
there is a stream of consciousness made up of moments. Everything that
yes.
exists is made up of pieces, and mind is made up of moments. So each of those moments of mind is moments of mind. But they are the component of Rabina, the overall person called Rabina. Would you agree?
Yes.
So then, where is the piece in here among the parts that is separate from those moments of mind and is separate from my body? Where is that part? What's that piece called? Where's that Rabina?
Why does it need to be separate from the moments of mind?
That's what we're just proving. We're proving if it's a conventional statement that there is, that if there's a, we're trying to prove that conventionally speaking, it's a true statement that my table has a cup, a plate, and a clock. If that's a true statement,
mm-hmm.
you have to isolate four phenomena. Would you agree?
Yes.
That we're trying to isolate four phenomena here as well.
Okay.
So we've isolated the nose, the hand, and the foot. We're trying to isolate the piece called Rabina that isn't the nose, the hand, and the foot, and everything else. So what is it? Where's the piece called Rabina? Which is the one we think exists, which is the cause of all suffering, Buddha says. Believing in one. He says it doesn't exist. And that we're believing in it is why we suffer. Just to hear, remind that point. So where's the piece that isn't nose, isn't hand, isn't foot, isn't mind, that's called Rabina? Because if it's a true statement, you have to find four separate phenomena. four separate phenomena, each of which is not the other.
And why can it not be mind?
Well, okay, what's the definition of mind? Mind is your thoughts. Would you agree? Good enough for now. Mind is your thoughts, yeah? You agree? Mind is my thoughts.
It's also...
Okay, no, wait. Mind is my thoughts. Mind is thoughts.
Okay.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and we have sensory consciousness as well. But we have consciousness, mind, which is a which cognizes phenomena. That's what the that's what the definition of mind is. That which is clear and that which cognizes things. That's the definition of a part of Rabina called mind. That's the definition of mind. But but Rabina is a combination of mind and body. So if you want the mind to be just Rabina, then what are you going to do with the body? Where's you've got to have a new definition of Rabina. What's Rabina made up of? What are the main components Rabina's
Rabina
made up of?
Rabina is the owner of...
But that's what my point. Point out that owner. Point that piece out that isn't the mind and isn't the body. That's the point.
It's the self without which karma cannot function. Because I have
You've got
my
to point
karma.
It out. You've got to
karma.
Point it out if it exists. It's got to be findable. It's not it's not tricky. It's scientific. If it is existing as a dependent, as a phenomenon, it has to be a single phenomenon that isn't something else. So among the parts of Rabina, where's the part that is called Rabina that isn't the other parts?
The actor?
But where is that part? Point it out to me among the parts. Give it a name. Is that the actor is another term for Rabina.
Mm-hmm.
Actor is another term for person. Mm-hmm. They're all terms we're using for the combination of the body and mind of the parts, like cup. Okay, point out, do you agree that a cup is made of clay and paint, say?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then let's separate the clay and let's separate the paint. Where's the cup?
You could have the cup without the paint.
Okay. Get my point. The components of this cup here, we say my cup has a handle, don't we?
Yes.
Okay. So then the assumption is there's a handle and there's a cup that has it. Yeah? You agree?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A car. A car has wheels. A car has doors. A car has a steering wheel. A car has seats. A car has an engine. A car has a trunk. You agree?
Yes.
Well, put the trunk there. Then put the seats there, and then put the steering wheel there, and put the engine there, and put the doors there, and put the tires there. Where's the car that isn't those parts? So, conclusion, Buddha is saying that I is a name we give to these parts, that cup is a name we give to these parts. The car is a name we give to those parts, and this is a subtle dependent arising, that there is no car among the parts, because the car is a name we impose, we label upon the parts. So there is no car inherent, intrinsic in the parts.
If you were a soldier in Afghanistan and you ran into a roadside bomb, how many parts?
Millions,
can
trillions.
Millions, trillions.
Millions, trillions. But that's not the discussion. Whether it's one or trillions of parts is not the point.
How many
how
parts
many.
Can you lose and still be a person?
As long as the mind and body are together.
Okay.
As long as mind and body are functioning, then there's a person there. Because the components of a car, as long as the wheels and the engine are going, it's still labeled a car. But as soon as it doesn't go, it's not a car. Well, as long as the mind and even a part of the body is functioning, there's a person there. But if they're separated, it's not a person. But so, the mind isn't the I, the body isn't the I, but I is merely a name we impose on those parts. It's like a convenience. It's all just smoke and mirrors. And everything you point to is the same. The ear. So then we'll go, well, Rabina's made up of parts. Oh, thank God, there are some parts in, yeah? No. What's ear? It's a name we impart, we put on the, by the mind, on its parts. Oh, we'll go, oh, thank God, there's a lobe. No. Lobe is a name we give to its parts. So everything's like that. It's like the smoke and mirrors. Like, that's what they mean by illusion. Smoke and mirrors. There is a cup that does function to hold my tea, but there's no cup from its own side. There's no inherent little cup in there. There's no, whereas we believe with 1,000,000,000% there's a little I in here. Then when you insult me and hurt me, the I rises. I did not do that. I, you know, as Pavanga Ruje says, when you nearly fall over the mountain, you don't go, oh, my body nearly fell over the mountain. You go, I nearly fell over the mountain. Because we believe this is I. And Buddha says we've been believing in this intrinsic, inherent, permanent, eternalistic, forever, inherent I since beginningless time, and it is the belief in this I is the cause of all suffering, period. So it's quite a dramatic belief, and so primordial, and so instinctive, and so assumed as truth, that it's just like a nonsense. And Lama Zopa says, we've got to have the words right. These words are right. These words, we're ticking all the boxes. We've got all the words right here so far. I can say that with confidence. But he says, you've got a realization of it. Two signs of success. The first one is unbelievable fear. And then even better, complete joy. You've found the truth. So way to go for that one. Because we can say all these words, then you come and punch me in the nose. Believe me, I'll grasp at my eye. I promise you I will. And get, I, you offended me. Because we believe there's a little mini me in there running the show like a puppeteer, you know. And even another way to discuss it is this one. I like this. Is another way to look at it. If you think of your mind, I like, you know, the roommate's idea. We've got millions of thoughts in there. You agree? We've got millions of thoughts. And this is the point about what a valid thought is. Buddha says the deluded thoughts, they're thoughts. They are thoughts, but they're thoughts that aren't correct thoughts. Just like I say there are two cups on my table. Given conventional reality, meaning we've all agreed that that's one, we've all agreed that's a cup, so we've all agreed this is therefore that we know the words, there is one cup on my table, is the truth. You guys know it's the truth, right? So, that's a thought, isn't it? In your mind, there is a thought, there is one cup on my table. And in my mind, there's another thought that says there are two cups. You agree they're both thoughts, aren't they? But you have to agree, this is what a valid thought is. It's very grounding. A thought that's valid is a thought that has a basis of truth. Conventional truth. Conventional truth. So we just proved it. We know the numbers. We know what cup is. We know that's my table. So you can easily prove it to me. It's not meant to be like, you see, we think truth is something from on high. God has made truth and it's to be believed in. That's the eternalistic kind of view. Buddha says truth is conventional truth, and it can be proven easily, and it proves dependent arising. Because who made up cup? We did. We decided one means that. Just a sound come out of the mouth. We decided cup is that. We decided to do it this way. It didn't come from God, creator. It's not inherently existent as a cup. It's a cup because we call it a cup, which is the meaning of dependent arising. But it functions. It's very comfortable. It's very convenient. So anyway, the thoughts in our mind. There are all the negative thoughts, Buddha says, that have this function of being liars. They're thoughts that don't have a basis in reality. And that's what we're trying to discover. Just like the attachment thought. My attachment over-exaggerates on this cup qualities it doesn't possess in itself. And if they did, you'd all see them. There could not be a cup that's called ugly by somebody else. Because each of our minds has got a bit of a slant in it. It's a non-truth. We think it's because we think the beautiful cup is there. We think the beautiful cup is there. That's why I'm going to fight with you when you say it's ugly. No. I've got a thought in my mind. Due to my delusions, I over-exaggerate it. And your mind over-exaggerates it. The cup has got nothing to do with it. There's an innocent thing out there that we dump our junk on, you know. So, in our mind, trillions of thoughts. And what we're trying to sort out in our mind is the thoughts that don't have a basis in reality. And they're all the so-called negative ones. And, you know, and they're the ones based on this ego grasping, on the very sense of an inherent self and inherent everything else, that all the others lie. All the others are underpinned by this one. So what we have to try and discover is in all these thoughts, we have a thought called I. So conventionally speaking, as we discussed, Robina is the name for this person in this chair. This is a fact. Conventionally speaking, the dependent arising called Robina. So it's when someone says, what's your name? I'll say, oh, I'm Robina. It's a conventional truth. But our problem is, when I say I'm Robina, it's sort of like there's a feeling of, I'm Robina. You trying to get my point? You trying to exaggerate Robina, you know? And we all have this view of our own sense of self, fat one, thin one, ugly, sheepish, pathetic. Oh, I'm Robina, I'm nobody. Oh, I'm Robina, I'm so special. You can tell immediately how we all talk. We're packed with all these ideas about who we are, you know. That's our view of who Robina is. All these made-up stories in our head. So you keep stripping away, you know, until eventually you discover there's no Robina at all. I mean, that's, you know, way to go. So we believe there is, like there. When we say I, look at our thoughts all day. I is the central player. And it's not just a conventional I. It's the wrong I. There's a little the person in there who's running the show, who's the owner, who's the hurt one, the pathetic one, the self-pity one, the not fair one, the one who's been bad to, mean to, who's beautiful, who's ugly, who's been rejected, who's been harmed, who's been angry, who is this, who isn't that. The dramas. The dramas we have around this person. We write a novel just to describe ourselves. And then we believe it's permanent. This is who I am. And then we identify ourselves either by our race, you know, by our gender, by our shape, by our mental characteristics, by our being good at music or art or you name it. It's highly complex how we identify this I. And then we believe that's the I. Real. Permanent, unchanging, definite, inherent. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. Coughing. So don't ever chuck the baby out with the bathwater. But it feels like that's the scariest hell, you know. So. But always the example I use of Lama Zopa, who's a little boy, 8 years old. He is said to be the reincarnation of a previous yogi up in the Sherpa mountains, you know? Sherpa. He was known as Kunsang Yeshi. He was a meditator, 30 years or something. A layman, meditator. He spent his last years in his cave. And then he passed away, and then he was born to this woman who was one of the attendants, so all these benefactors to the yogi, you know, in the mountains. And then from the time he could crawl, apparently, his sister said, from the time the moment his mother would turn her back, he'd be crawling up the mountain, you know, towards where the cave was. Because they all say these reincarnated lamas, vivid memory when they're very small, they know exactly who they are, you know. So he wants to get back on the job, continue meditating. So then as soon as he can talk, you know, he's walking up the mountain, come home. And she, you know, he'd say, no, that is my home. So anyway, she checks up with the local lamas, and they seem to indicate that he is the reincarnation of Kunsang Yeshi. That's when he got known as Rinpoche, you know. So also, the sister said, the only games he ever played was being a lama. He'd sit there and make his mud pie bells and dorjis and his mud pie tormas, and then he'd announce sometimes that all his benefactors from down the mountain were coming to puja. Well, he'd announce all the names of his previous life benefactors, you know. So this is when the mother figured, well, she better check up who he is. They say a lot when they're younger, they're very clear in their memory, you know. So anyway, one time when he was about 8, once he was formally recognized as a Rinpoche, and he had his manager, they're very professional, these people. He was up in some cave up in some monastery up in the mountains, and he told the story about how he saw across his, there's a very big river, you know, quite turbulent river, and across the other side, all these people, strangers, foreigners, they must have been Anglos, they were pale-faced, you know, white people. And he was fascinated. So many of his students later on were white people. In fact, now he's all colour people, but he had white people in the beginning. Western students. So anyway, he was really determined to go over there and meet them. So you don't go empty-handed. You want to bring a gift. So he had his bowl of potatoes. His manager didn't want him to go because it's quite a rickety bridge. But he insisted. He's quite stubborn, apparently. So then he fell into the river with his potatoes, you know. And of course, they don't teach them swimming there. So he can't swim. And so the way he told the story, I remember he said, the head kept popping up and down for air. And he saw his manager running along the bank, you know. So already that alone is interesting. What would we say? My head. I was coming up for air, you know. Isn't it? A complete panic. In our culture, this is what we say scientifically. We say we've all got this instinct for survival. We observe animals. We observe humans. And indeed, we do have. And guess what Buddha would call that? Ego grasping. The millisecond I is offended, upset, hurt, threatened. This is what happens. His ego grasping rises like a huge panic-stricken lion and his complete freak out. Because this is what's fascinating in Buddhist psychology. That ego grasping, the root delusion, the mistaken sense of self, and all the other delusions, which are the product of it, are all in the nature of fear. It's fascinating. They don't call, in the list of delusions, fear is not given its own status. And it's really hardly even stated too strongly, but it's very powerful when you can see this, that fear is the natural state of this ego grasping and all delusions. It's just the why we have so much despair in our world. It's fear because of delusions. Love and compassion, they're not fearful. They, in their nature, are virtuous. So the point is this. He first says the head was up and going up and down. And then he said, this is the point too, the person known as the loud... Oh, he said, sorry. He said, I didn't know anything about emptiness, meaning in that life he was 8, he hadn't learned the teachings. But from this response, and this is me, we can deduce that he had emptiness, a realization in his mind, because of the response that he had. He said, the head, and then he said, the person, I didn't know anything about emptiness, but the person, it occurred to me that the person known as the Lao Tzu Lama, it was a little village, well, a cave in the wall, a hole in the wall where they stored the radishes, and he pulled the radishes out and moved in. So he got known as that was Lao Tzu, the radishes, so he got known as the Radish Lama. He was the Radish Lama. So he said, the person known as the Lao Tzu Lama is about to die. And then he said, but there was no fear. So in other words, this is a part that we can't conceive of. When, you know, there is in the mind of a person, when they have realized the absence of the fantasy I, doing all this work, actual genuine realization, an actual insight, then there is no fear. Fear is gone because delusions are gone. Therefore, there's nothing to cling to. But this is what's fascinating, because we would then think, if he didn't have instinct for survival, he would have sort of sunk to the bottom of the river like a stone. Oh, well, I'm dying. What the hell? But no, he still kind of struggled. You would have seen a struggling child in the water coming up for air. But the point is, his mind was not disturbed. And that's inconceivable to us, because there were not delusions in his mind. Can you hear the point? It's very fascinating. Look how easily disturbed we are. I mean, the mind, the smallest thing happens. And we're frantic. I, this, I, that, they, this, he, that, everything. The central player is I. And it's the belief in the inherent I, so primordial, so instinctive, so utter, so total, so complete. And it's always the dramas and the hurt and the pain and not being seen and lonely and depressed and unhappy and jealous and angry and proud and arrogant and hate and all of those are the voices. On the basis of the belief in this I. And this is what Buddha means by being in samsara. You've got to admit it's interesting. I think it's very delicious. So now, let's get to the word emptiness. What the hell's that got to do with anything? Because that seems to throw us completely. No wonder we get nihilistic. We think emptiness sounds like nihilistic. No. And again, once we get used to the way the words are used, this will give us real insight into this stuff, you know. I always use the same example. It's a good one. It's a simple one. It's a practical one. You're colorblind, okay? So what's your name? You with the shirt. You, Coben. What's your shirt say, darling?
Goblin.
Goblin. So what's your name?
Tony.
Okay, Tony. So use Tony. Let's say Tony's colorblind. Let's say he's useless and he's colorblind.
You're about half right already.
Okay, darling. So let's say you, when you look at this blue cup, you see red. That's a possibility, isn't it? It is possible, isn't it? We all know that. He's, in other words, he's deluded. He's seeing something on this cup that doesn't exist. Would you agree? Isn't he? He's seeing, he's got a misconception, all these words, he's got a misconception in his mind that causes something to appear here in this cup that doesn't exist in this cup. That's a way of saying it. This is exactly how Buddha talks. He says right now we're seeing things in phenomena and people and everything that don't exist there, but we can't see we don't see it. So he is seeing something that doesn't exist here. He sees red. You agree? So we don't just bully him into seeing the truth. That would be not fair. Or interestingly, we think because things are subjective. I remember one person saying, well, if I see it as red, I'm allowed to see it as red. Well, you, well, of course you are. But it won't do you much good. You'll just get into trouble and fight with people. You know, so there's a conventional reality here, and this is called blue. Okay, you might as well get on, you know, get on the case. Be on the same page as everybody else. It does help. So, okay. Okay, so now we wouldn't just bully him into seeing the truth, would we? We would then check up. There must be a problem. First we agree, we make sure there's no other valid cognitions in this room that say it's red. We all agree that it's blue, so we go, okay, let's sort it out. Let's try and help Tony here. So we fix his glasses. Let's say we fix the lighting. We check his English language. Maybe he just learned the wrong words at school, you know? And we check his eyes. Well, there's no other real component we'd have to fix, is there? They're the main players. Would you agree with that? You'd agree, isn't it? So we fix all those, and then we show him the cup again. Now, what will he see this time? What will he see? But we just fixed his eyes, I just told you. Didn't you hear that? No, it's important. Did you hear that part?
I heard that.
Well, then why would he see red again? The whole point is to fix the problem. What, dear? Oh, darling, well, just, it's an example. There's no point in the conversation if we just pretend, you know, pretend we can fix the problem. We fixed the problem. What will he see when he looks again? Okay, what else do people think he'll see? Not red. Okay, Tony, what do you think you'll see when you see when you look again? When we fix the problems, what will you think you'll see?
Not red.
Right. Well, make it slightly more vivid. That will, another word for this. Okay, get the point here. He is, because he has seen red every time he sees blue, meaning he's built up the habit of seeing red, hasn't he? Therefore, he's going to expect to see red, isn't he? And so he'll get probably quite a shock, won't he? And he'll probably go, oh my God, it's not red. Wouldn't he do that? You see what I'm saying? Oh my God, it's not red, he'll say. Well, another way to put that, what he saw is the absence of red. It's a way of putting it. Turn what he saw into a noun. Into a thing, a phenomenon that does exist. So would you, and this is important use of words, I'm not just being pedantic here, this is a really crucial point. Buddha says all kinds of phenomena exist, and our job is to be in sync with that which exists. So would you agree that blue exists on this cup? Yeah? So for Tony, once we've established, he's fixed his eyes, the very first moment he looks at it, he's going to see the absence of red very vividly, isn't he? So would you agree that for Tony, in the beginning, when he gets to see it for the first time, when he's realized the truth, he is just, that there's an absence of red on this cup, isn't there? Okay, you can also argue, well, just being stupid, well, there's an absence of elephant as well. But it's not the point. The point is for the person who thinks there's red there, that the absence of red is very vivid. Obviously, you have a realization of blue. You don't care about the absence of red. You just know the truth. But for a person who's making a mistake, it's very powerful when you fix the problem, and now he looks again, he'll see the truth. But the first truth he'll see is the absence of red, and that's what emptiness is. It's the emptiness of the inherent I. So all Buddha, using the same logic, the same words, what Buddha's saying is, this ignorance is imposing on self and cups and clocks and everything that exists a characteristic that doesn't exist there, which is the source of all suffering, which sounds dramatic, but this is what he's saying. And that characteristic is simply called inherent rabina, inherent cup. We don't even know what it means. It means a thing that's not depending on something. But it's all very abstract for us. But just get the idea of the words. But we are, everything we see, everything we experience, everything we think about, everything we hear, because of this ignorance, so primordial, it's like it suffuses everything. Everything is suffused with this mistake. So it's so total, we never know we're doing it. It's like every time he sees blue, he sees red. It's not as if for 1 hour a day he sees the truth. So he'll have something to compare with. But if he never ever sees anything but red, he doesn't ever think he's making a mistake, does he? So we never ever see anything as it is. We might get milliseconds of glimpses, but then it's gone in a second. We're back to the mistake. So because we only ever are seeing things wrongly, Then finally, after all the purification and all the work, we have even a momentary glimpse of the truth. It's the absence of the inherent I. They say it's this paradigm shift that will occur in your mind. And when you have a first genuine realization, even intellectual realization is helpful. Even to understand the words is so powerful and necessary, because you can't leap to a genuine realization. You've got to go step by step. The first step is get the theories and the words right. Think about, debate, use logic, understand it. Because theoretical confidence is very powerful. Conceptual confidence. You can have conceptual realizations of something. Then it leads slowly, slowly, as you meditate, as you purify, to a direct, non-conceptual insight into it. You see the truth for the first time. And from that second, you're already climbing out of samsara. For that second, you cannot fall back. It's so primordial, so powerful, that moment, that insight, that non-conceptual insight, the seeing of the vivid absence of the inherent I, the I that has never existed in the first place. Blue bread could exist, but the inherent I could never exist. So just once we get the words right, then you can string them together in coherent sentences, and then you have a basis for proper thinking. Rather than we think, well, emptiness, 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 no idea what it means, oh my God, I can't think of it. Emptiness is too difficult, because you don't learn the words, of course it's difficult. You'll never come till the cows come home until you learn the words. Because the words are what you use to think about to trigger the insight. Are you with me, people?
Yeah.
So any questions, please? Yeah. And this is not just meant to be clever intellectual stuff. This is real words for real experiences that we need to get in order to stop suffering.
Hello?
Oh. Yeah.
Okay. So my question, I guess, is about accountability. So you said that there is this nihilistic way of looking at it, that I'm not accountable for being here, I'm not to blame. And then there's the karma way of looking at it, that everything that I am now,
yes,
I'm responsible
for.
That's
right, for it. Exactly, yeah.
So if there is no I, then who are you putting the accountability on?
Okay, this is the common trap we fall into, and it's very natural we do this, because what's happening here using these words, you've just become nihilistic. You've just said if there's no I, which means there's no I, then how can there be dependent arising? But they don't contradict, and that's the tricky part. So you can say, what's your name?
Olga. Olga.
Olga. Okay. So Olga is the name we give to this person here, this body and mind combination, okay? So then body is the name we give to the physical bits of the basis of Olga, and mind is the name we give to all those thoughts and feelings, right? You agree with that? So those thoughts and feelings in this body does exist, don't they? So conventionally speaking. But if you did the analysis, we'd have to say there's no mind from its own side and there's no body from its own side. And then we'd say there's no Olga from her own side. And then we'd say, well, there's no ear from its own side. We'd say that about everything. But conventionally, Olga is the name for this person. So mind is the name for the mind of Olga. And body is the name for the body of Olga. So Olga, since she's conceived, has been doing and thinking and saying things. Do you agree with that? So this empty mind of empty Olga has been doing empty things like, you know, being angry and getting depressed and harming people and being loving and kind and compassionate. Would that be true? Mm-hmm. So each of those in this mind that does exist but not inherently, you have left imprints that do exist but not inherently in this non-inherent mind. So it's like smoke and mirrors. There is a mind, there is reincarnation, there is a person, there is Olga, there is karma, there is cause, there is effect, but not from their own side. So the feeling we have is there's no Olga and there's no anything and just innocent victim me, and I'm sitting here greedily waiting for good things to happen and angrily pushing away the ugly things. That's the experience of a feeling. That there either is an eternalistic Olga in there, or there's no Olga at all. Kill myself or be happy, you know. So there is an Olga, but not from her own side. There is negative karma, but not from its own side. There is positive karma, but not from its own side. There is a continuity of consciousness, but not from its own side. There is past life, but not from its own side. There is a future life, but not from its own side.
Okay. Well, it's hard to argue with that, but
it's just.
Okay, so the other thing
is... In other words, darling, emptiness doesn't contradict that Olga exists as a convention.
Right. Well, the way that I'm understanding you is that it does exist, it just changes.
Well, that's one... Okay, impermanence is an excellent one to start getting first. It can lead us to emptiness. It's not the same as emptiness. Emptiness is far more subtle. And a really good realization to get is that things are changing moment to moment. That can lead us to emptiness, and that's already a good realization. So well done, yes. So
then, well, the other thing is that I'm coming from a physics background.
Yep.
So to me, when I'm trying to digest it, I'm trying to, I guess, do it in a mechanical way.
Yeah.
And the thing that comes up to my mind is, could I be the kind of like the propellant or the force that's changing my mental state? So, for example, I'm in a good mental state, a virtuous one, and then I am the force that changes it negative one.
No, that's a completely example of a dualistic mistaken view. The Buddha's saying there doesn't need to be an I. Because, okay, good. Let's look at Olga's mind. Olga's mind is made up of lots and lots of components. Like everything that exists, would you agree, is made up of lots of components? And those components, speaking simply here, we could say there are positive states of mind and there are negative states of mind. Okay, right? A building is made up of lots of bricks. Yeah? You pull a few bricks out here, it'll go that way. And you put another brick up there, it'll go this way. Okay, there's a you that does it. But the building itself, it's just made up of its parts. So Olga's mind is made up of parts. So let's say there's the virtuous tendency to be kind is very strong in this mind. So that combined with some wisdom, combined with some discrimination, combined with some conscience, combined with a few other parts that are strong in Olga's mind, they all work very nicely together to have a kind moment. You don't need an Olga to make it happen. But then one day, a tendency to be angry rises, and that's supported by this little piece and that little piece and this little piece. Then that runs the show for 10 minutes. You don't need an Olga to do it. They do it nicely on their own. We don't need a governor. We don't need a landlord. So our mind is made of all these bits. And if the deluded ones are most strong, then it'll be sounding like a madhouse in there. So then they don't need an Olga to run them. They don't need a landlord. They do nicely on their own. That's Buddha's point. He says the idea of a self or a creator is an unnecessary exaggeration, an unnecessary embellishment. We don't need an I to do it. The bits and pieces work very nicely together.
Okay,
you see what I'm saying?
Yep.
So like your hand, there's no little inherent hand in there that's telling the fingers what to do. They all are working beautifully together. And the illusion, the overall illusion is of a whole hand. But it's just made of all these bits working nicely. You don't need a little inherent hand to make it happen. So the bits of Olga work nicely together to produce an ugly Olga or a loving Olga. You know? So my friend, I was saw my friends on death row yesterday in Kentucky. And I remember one of my friends, he tells me about one of the guys there who thinks of torture all the time. So we can deduce, there's no little Fred, I don't know what his name is, there's no Fred in there that's saying, I must have dirty thoughts and torturing thoughts. But the torturing tendency in his mind, since he's a tiny boy, is running itself, honey. So then, of course, he identifies, I am a torturer. But there's no I apart from the torturing. So my other friend, Mitch, who's a Buddhist, he has changed his mind. So that means he had the tendency for goodness and tendency for kindness and tendency for forgiveness and to accept responsibility. In his mind, they were latent. He was an old druggie on the streets and he killed somebody. Now in prison with a new condition, those ones are coming to the fore. So they're new little bricks into the building, you know, new little pieces. There doesn't need to be a Mitch who decides it. And that's the interesting way we think there has to be a little boss there. We don't need a boss. And that's Buddha's view with karma. There's no one running the story. There's no one pulling the strings. There's no one making it happen. There's no one judging and rewarding, which is the dualistic feeling we have about everything. It's all judgment, reward. That's why we want to be seen to be good, and we don't want to be seen to be bad, because we're instinctively feeling that there is this boss out there somewhere, you know, either in our head or mummy or daddy or God. It's an unnecessary embellishment, Buddha says. Things work nicely on their own. That's why we can have confidence that there's no state of mind that's permanent. We can change all of them. We use the convention, we will change. It's just comfortable talk, you know. But that all thoughts can change. Things are impermanent. They are impermanent, yes. And that should give us great confidence. We're not stuck in stone.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm, yeah, that clears it up.
Good, darling, good. Here. Yes, sweetheart, yeah, over here, too.
Which way?
So, the word emptiness, empty of inherent existence.
Sorry, darling?
So, the empty of inherent existence,
yes.
That means that, doesn't mean that there's nothing there.
No.
It just means that there's nothing that's inherent.
There is a cup there, but
yes.
There's nothing in the cup that's inherent or intrinsic or definite or absolute or solid from its own side that makes it a cup.
So that's the empty part.
That's right.
So that's
the absence of that fantasy that we impose on the cup. Yeah.
Okay. So it's not. That, I think that's why you think of the nihilism
it's very instinctive
empty.
In us to feel there's nothing when we get depressed and hopeless. So we run to that anyway. When we
right.
hear those words, we hear it that way.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, honey.
Thank you. In this little Vajrasattva practice, this has always been confusing to me. In the dedication, it says, in emptiness, there is no I,
okay.
creator of negative karma.
Good, okay.
There is no action
okay,
of
good.
Creating negative karma.
Good.
And this is the one that gets me.
Good.
There is no negative karma.
Right, precisely,
creates.
Of course. That's right, exactly. Of course it's not. From its own side, which does not contradict that there is negative karma.
Okay.
You see, that's the thing. So let's look at this one.
Yes.
Let's look at this. Let's look at this. Let's look at this. You see, when we think emptiness, we think, oh, we're projecting everything onto things. So we're just projecting. Then we think somehow, but then we think of a good person. We think bad people. We just project bad things onto them. Then we think of a good person. And let's say the Buddha or Dalai Lama. Well, we're just projecting onto the Dalai Lama. But he is a good person. Then we think, well, how can he be empty? It seems like bad things are empty, but we can't work out how good things can be empty. So the point is this. Just some words first. Buddha says that if something does exist conventionally, a Buddha, hell realm, killing somebody, negativity, you, a peanut, I don't care what it is, if it does exist, it is a dependent arising. A few things come together that to produce a thing called a negative action. There has to be a person, there has to be a tendency, there has to be the hand going out, take the money, and put it in the pocket. All those components are called a negative action. So how do we define a negative action? A negative action is one that harms another. So why is it negative when you do it? Because in your mind there's a thing called greed. So the greed is running the show there. The greed makes the hand go out. The greed puts the money in. The greed goes, oh, wow, I'm so rich now, I'm so happy. So that altogether, there's a person labeled you, there's a hand of the person, there's the greed in the mind, there's the money in the pocket. They all come together and it produces a negative action. But there's no negative action from its own side, baby. Because if there were, you couldn't unseparate them. You couldn't pull them apart, and it could never be any different.
And you'd always have.
And that's how we think of negativity. We think it's an absolute sin. It's just a sin because someone said, and it's evil. Why is it evil? Just because it is. This is nonsense.
Uh-huh.
You just change one of the bricks. Pull out one brick. Like you can have exactly the same action: a person, a hand, a thought. I want the money. And you can go and put the hand out, but the motivation is to pick it up to give it to the poor person. The exact same action, but one piece has changed, and it's the motivation. So the one piece has changed. It looks like a negative action. Well, she stole $5, but they didn't see you give it to the next person. So as soon as one piece changes, just one piece in that whole action, there's you, a hand, going out, taking $5. But one piece changed, motivation. I want to help. I want to get that money to give it to somebody. Then the whole thing is, so where's the negative action? It suddenly changed to a positive action now. Same components, no one's different. So where is it? So that's a dependent arising. Everything is made up of parts and pieces, but it is that's labelled a negative action. That one's labelled a positive action. This is labelled Mary. That's labelled Fred. But there's no inherent Mary, inherent Fred, inherent good or inherent bad, but there's relative good and relative bad and relative Mary and relative Fred.
Thank you. You got that through my thick skull.
So therefore, to think of the end of always when we do the purification, it's really good to do that when they talk about the emptiness of the three circles. There is no I, there is no action of killing. There's no I that killed. There's no action of killing, and there's no object that got killed from their own side. But there is an I, relatively speaking, that did kill, and there is an object of killing these things. So it's relative and ultimate go together. We see them as separate. We hear empty, we hear nihilist. We hear there's something, oh, it's concrete. So we the world is concrete, absolute. There is evil. Now, how we love to paint people as saints or sinners. You know, we love to have perfect people who or evil people. And when we see what evil, we love to, they're the two extremes. And we see it as absolute and permanent. That divine Fred, when he was your best friend, you adore him. Now he's your evil ex-husband. And he's evil from the head to his toe. You will not change your mind. You just see evil. He's evil in his bones. That's the view of inherent. Inherent Fred. I mean, one action changed. He decided he fell in love with Mary. It didn't mean he wasn't kind to you for 30 years. He was. But we forget all that. We just see ugly Fred now. Because all delusions exaggerate, you know. Mm-hmm. Exaggerate. So there is no I from it. And this is why it's so helpful. You see, okay, another way to put it, which is very tasty. The Buddha is saying, literally, that things do exist. There is negativity, there is goodness, there is enlightenment, there is a toe, there is a peanut, there is a person, because they are empty of being inherent toe, person, enlightenment, etc. Because if they were the point the Buddha's making, another way to say it. Empty of inherent existence means lacking means not dependent. It means not dependent. So we know everything that exists in simple terms it depends on something. You know, you say the word short. It's only existing in reference to long. It does not have. There's no such thing as an inherent short. You cannot have short that doesn't refer to long. It's not possible. You can't have. It's a simple example of emptiness. It's an impossibility to have an inherent short. Everything exists like this. There's nothing that exists that doesn't depend upon something for its existence. So the simplest way of saying empty of inherent is empty of independent. Empty of being interdependent. Lacking interdependence, meaning being independent. Nothing can exist independently of something else. Therefore, emptiness of existing independently is a simple way to put it, which means everything is dependent. Dependent arising means not independent. Can you hear? Mm-hmm. Empty of being independent is a simple way to put it. Independent of what? Causes, conditions, parts, mind, labeling, the subtlest one. Nothing can exist in isolation, on its own, without existing independence upon this or that. There's nothing you posit that exists. So therefore, everything is empty of being independent. Has to be. There's no choice. Everything that exists is a dependent arising. So things exist because they're empty of being independent. They're empty. They lack being independent. They're not independent. They can't be. Empty of independent is a fancy way of saying not independent. And it's a fancy way of saying dependent. Just got to get our head around the words, that's all. Get used to the words. And it's the words that throw us. Then we think they're inherently difficult. So we never penetrate them and use them and try to squeeze our brains enough to get used to them, you know. So the absence of something is very vivid. That's why they talk a lot about emptiness as a thing that does exist. The absence of inherent does exist. So we said here, the absence of red, blue does exist on this cup. The absence of red does exist on this cup. On this person, there does exist the absence of inherent person. On this person here, there does exist a characteristic called emptiness of inherent existence. So giving emptiness a status as something that's vividly existing, not just some... Okay, another example, how we tend to think of emptiness as nihilistic, that example I use about the keys in the drawer. You're running late, your keys are in the drawer, definite. And you open the drawer and you get a big shock. Oh my God, no keys. So you did not see an empty drawer, did you? You saw a very vivid thing called the absence of keys in your drawer, did you not? You got a shock. But what I saw in the drawer when I just stuck my nose in your drawer, poking my nose into your business, I open the drawer, I go, huh, what a boring old drawer, nothing in there. I just saw empty drawer, didn't I? That's how we think of emptiness. Like you chuck everything out, there's nothing left. That's nihilism. No, what you saw is so vivid, it's so real, it's so huge, it's like gigantic. You get my point here? The absence of keys is a vivid, vivid thing that does exist for you, hey? You see my point? Don't just, you know, oh, there's nothing in the drawer. Oh, well, that's emptiness. Wrong. That's not how it is. It's a vivid thing. Oh, my God. You notice it, you know. Well, like I talk about, like say your hubby left you. Or he died on you, you know. Of course, people die. It's heartbreaking. All you can feel in your house for the first few weeks is the emptiness of Fred, isn't it? The house feels like absolutely empty. Or if you're dying for a husband or a boyfriend. Every time you walk into your house, all you see is an empty house, isn't it? Because you're expecting something to be there. Because you want something to be there that isn't there, isn't it? But if I walk in your house, I'm, oh, what a lovely house. I won't feel the emptiness of Fred. I won't feel the emptiness of the boyfriend you're dying to have. You see my point? So the emptiness of something is a vivid thing that is for the person who expects it to be there. For the person who thought it was there. This room is empty of elephants. It's a fact. But who cares? It's not the point. It's only if you believe there's an elephant in the room that it's important. You see my point? Well, you believe your money's in the bank and you suddenly see a minus against the number instead of a plus. You have a mental breakdown, you know, because you expected there to be a plus. So the emptiness is in reference to what's in the mind. Can you hear me? The point. So don't hear it as some abstract nothingness. It's just a way of talking, but it's important to make it like a noun. That's the way I like to say it. Make it a noun. Not just, oh, there aren't any keys in my drawer. Turn it into a knowable thing. It's called absence of keys. It's a very vivid phenomenon that does exist. So in the Heart Sutra, it says, there's no wisdom, there's no attainment, and there's even no non-attainment. Non-attainment means emptiness of inherent attainment. So even the emptiness of inherent attainment, which does exist on attainment, it too is empty. So whatever does exist, to really double check us, to really make sure, whatever does exist. So in other words, there is blue on this cup, and that blue is empty of inherent existence. And there is on this cup the absence of blue, and that absence, that emptiness of blue is also empty of inherent existence. So the emptiness of Ravina upon the parts is empty of inherent existence as well. Whatever does exist is necessarily empty. Whatever does exist, including the emptiness of inherent existence, is also a dependent arising because it's empty. So just double-checking and making that point extra clear in Buddha in the Heart Sutra. So just getting used to the words, people. We're all super intelligent in the West. You geniuses with maths and physics and, you know, but people, oh, I can't understand emptiness. Just intellectual laziness, that's all. Takes time. But we can. And I tell you, it is easier than bodhicitta. Easier than love. Well, this nice thing, happy heart. What is on Friday? I'm too scared of it. Kind heart? Forget it. This is much easier, you know. Forget it. Kind heart's too much. Are we communicating here? Any questions? It's 9:01. Time to go home. Are we a bit clarity? As Lama Yeshe would say, clarity coming, dear? Anybody more confused than when they walked in? It's a good sign. It's okay.
What's the one taste part? When it says one taste,
what do you mean?
When you get to the end and the dedications, all is one taste.
Oh yeah, because when you realize
it's a metaphor.
That's the way they talk. When you realize emptiness, there's no dualism, there's no separate, there's no sense of a one. Okay, the very simple one is there's no when you've got bodhicitta and emptiness together and you become a Buddha, there is no longer a separate. Even bodhicitta, there's no longer a separate sense of self. There's no longer. When you've got emptiness and bodhicitta, there's no longer, it's one taste. But even when they're doing concentration meditation and you've gone beyond the gross conceptual thoughts, when you realize, when the emptiness and the object become of one taste, we have always subject-object, you know? There's mind cognizing something. And they say when you've got some realizations, they're like water and water mixed together of one taste. There's no dualism. There's a word for it, you know? Slowly. We can anticipate it. So that do tonight? Food for thought? Okay. Good. Thank you, everybody. So we delight in this. We try hard to realize this. We can realize it. We can understand it. Don't think you can't. Just learn it. Work on it. Think about it. Slowly the penny drops. Slowly, slowly, slowly the penny does drop. But you've got to be patient and plod along. Persevere. And this is where purification practice. It sounds a bit abstract to us. But, you know, this, we can all be very clever intellectually. But it's the work on the practicing patience and practicing humility and doing your practice every day and practicing the giving. That stuff, you know, and practicing all your other practices, that's the purification stuff, doing your four opponent powers. That weakens and loosens all the junk underneath that uphold ego grasping. So you've got to loosen that stuff, and that kind of loosens it a bit. You know, you get to start to see it one day, you know. You've got to, can't just do the intellectual one. That's not helpful. So we dedicate. We think, how marvelous, it's 2 hours, all these thoughts, a bit of clarity coming, slowly, slowly, you know, so that we really can see the absence of the fantasy eye, so we really, from our own side, can be blissful, eradicate the nonsense, find our own liberation, and then, on the basis of this, never giving up to help others too. Can't leave them alone. If I don't help, who will? Thinking this way, the two wings of the bird. Kewajin yududang lama sangge drob gyurne drowa chikyang malupa jayi sala kapashok Jang chob sem chog rin po che, ma kye pa nam ke gyu chig, kye pa nyam pa me pa yang, gong ne gong du pa ba shog. And may all our holy lamas, all our inspirations, you know, our lamas, Gejala, Lama Zobram Che, His Holiness, anyone we can see as an example, a living example, of the efficacy of these teachings, which gives us great courage, great confidence. That's the real function of the Lama, you know, to show us it's possible. We can do it too. So may they live long. May they all live long. We need them to show us the way. And may we become like them. As Pabongka Rinpoche says, my favorite quote, you better choose your guru very carefully because you're going to end up like them. Okay? So be selective. Okie doke.
And we'd like to also delight in the generosity of our sponsors. Tonight was sponsored by Richard and Susan Potter, who dedicates it to all our precious teachers, to their long and healthy lives, and may all of their teachings be of immediate benefit to all. May all beings quickly be released from the bondage of their negative karma and delusions. And also by Paul Hagwood.